and bounce back in our direction.
Move!
She cried, and I leapt away as she collided with the wall beside me, kicking a hole through the rotten planks. Enoch, the smallest of us, dove through first, followed by Emma, and before I could protest, Bronwyn had grabbed me by the shoulders and tossed me out into the wet night. I landed chest first in a puddle. The cold was shocking, but I was elated to feel anything other than the hollow's tongue wrapping around my throat. Emma and Enoch hauled me to my feet, and we took off running. A moment later, Emma shouted Bronwyn's name and stopped. We turned, realizing she hadn't come with us. We called for her and scanned the dark, not quite brave enough to run back, and then Enoch shouted,
"There!"
And we saw Bronwyn leaning against a corner of the ice house.
"What's she doing?"
cried Emma.
"Bronwyn, run!"
It looked as though she was hugging the building. Then she stepped back and took a running start and rammed her shoulder into its corner support, and like a house made of matchsticks, the whole thing tumbled in on itself, a cloud of pulverized ice and splintered wood puffing out and blowing down the street in a gust of wind. We all hollered and cheered as Bronwyn sprinted toward us with a manic grin on her face, then stood in the pelting rain, hugging her and laughing. It didn't take long for our moods to darken, though, as the shock of what had just happened set in, and then Emma turned to me and asked the question that must have been on all their minds.
"Jacob, how did that wight know so much about you? And us?"
"You called him doctor," said Enoch.
"He was my psychiatrist."
"Psychiatrist?" Enoch said. "That's just grand. Not only did he betray us to a wight, he's mad to boot."
"Take it back,"
Emma yelled, shoving him hard. He was about to shove back when I stepped between them.
"Stop," I said, pushing them apart.
I faced Enoch.
"You're wrong. I'm not crazy. He let me think I was, though all along he must have known I was peculiar. You're right about one thing, though. I did betray you. I told my grandfather's stories to a stranger."
"It's not your fault,"
Emma said.
"You couldn't have known we were real."
"Of course he could have,"
shouted Enoch.
"Abe told him everything. Even showed him bloody pictures of us."
"Golan knew everything but how to find you," I said, "and I led him straight here."
"But he tricked you," said Bronwyn.
"I just want you to know that I'm sorry." Emma hugged me.
"It's all right. We're alive."
"For now," said Enoch. "But that maniac is still out there. And considering how willing he was to feed us all to his pet Holligast, it's a good bet he's figured out how to get into the loop on his own."
"Oh, God, you're right," said Emma.
"Well, then," I said, "we'd better get back there before he does."
"And before it does," Bronwyn added.
We turned to see her pointing at the wrecked ice house, where broken boards had begun to shift in the collapsed pile.
"I imagine he'll be coming for us directly, and I'm fresh out of houses to drop on him."
Someone shouted, "Run!" But we already were, tearing down the path toward the one place the hollow couldn't reach us, the loop. We raced out of town in the dark, vague blue outlines of cottages giving way to sloping fields, then charged up the ridge, sheets of water streaming over our feet, making the path treacherous. Enoch slipped and fell. We hauled him up and ran on. As we were about to crest the ridge, Bronwyn's feet went out from under her too, and she slid down 20 feet before she could stop herself. Emma and I ran back to help, and as we took her arms, I turned to look behind us, hoping to catch a glimpse of the creature. But there was only inky, swirling rain. My talent for spotting hollows wasn't much good without light to see them by, but then, as we made it back to the top, chests heaving. A long flash of lightning lit up the night, and I turned and saw it. It was off below us a ways, but climbing fast, its muscular tongues punching into the mud and propelling it up the ridge like a spider.
"Go!"
I shouted, and we all bolted down the far side, the four of us sliding on our butts until we hit level ground and could run again. There was another flash of lightning. It was even closer than before. At this rate, there was no way we'd be able to outrun it.
Our only hope was to outmaneuver it.
If it catches us, it'll kill us all, I shouted. But if we split up, it'll have to choose. I'll lead it around the long way and try to lose it in the bog. The rest of you, get to the loop as quick you can.
You're mad, shouted Emma. If anyone stays behind, it should be me. I can fight it with fire.
Not in this rain, I said, and not if you can't see it.
I won't let you kill yourself, she shouted.
There was no time to argue, so Bronwyn and Enoch ran ahead while Emma and I veered off the path, hoping the creature would follow, and it did. It was close enough now that I didn't need a lightning flash to know where it was. The twist in my gut was enough. We ran arm in arm, tripping through a field rent with furrows and ditches, falling and catching each other in an epileptic dance. I was scanning the ground for rocks to use as weapons when, out of the darkness ahead, there appeared a structure, a small sagging shack with broken windows and missing doors, which in my panic I failed to recognize.
We have to hide, I said between gasping breaths.
Please let this creature be stupid, I prayed as we sprinted toward the house. Please, please let it be stupid. We made a wide arc, hoping to enter it unseen.
Wait,
Emma cried as we rounded the back of it. She pulled one of Enoch's cheesecloths from her coat and quickly tied it around a stone plucked from the ground, making a kind of slingshot. She cradled it in her hands until it caught fire and then hurled it away from us. It landed in the boggy distance, glowing weakly in the dark.
Misdirection, she explained,
and we turned and committed ourselves to the shack's concealing gloom. We slipped through a door that was hanging off its hinges and stepped down into a sea of dark, aromatic muck. As our feet sank with a nauseating squelch, I realized where we were.
What is this?
Emma whispered, and then a sudden exhalation of animal breath made us both jump. The house was crowded with sheep taking shelter from the unfriendly night, just as we were. As our eyes adjusted, we caught the dull gleam of theirs, staring back at us, dozens and dozens of them.
It's what I think it is, isn't it?
She said, lifting one foot gingerly. Don't think about it, I replied. Come on, we need to get away from this door. I took her hand and we pushed into the house, snaking through a maze of skittish animals that shied from our touch. We threaded a narrow hall and came into a room with one high window and a door that was still in its frame and closed against the night, which was more than could be said for the other rooms. Squeezing into the far corner, we knelt down to wait and listen, hidden behind a wall of nervous sheep. We tried not to sit too deeply in the muck, but there was really no helping it. After a minute of staring blindly into the dark, I began to make out shapes in the room. There were crates and boxes stacked in one corner, and along the wall behind us hung rusted tools. I looked for anything that might be sharp enough to serve as a weapon. Seeing something that looked like a pair of giant scissors, I stood up to grab it.
Planning on shearing some sheep, said Emma.
It's better than nothing. Just as I was taking the shears down from the wall, a noise came from outside the window. The sheep bleated anxiously, and then a long black tongue drifted through the glassless enclosure. I sank back to the floor as quietly as I could. Emma put her hand over her mouth to silence her breathing. The tongue poked around the room like a periscope, seeming to be testing the air. Luckily, we'd taken refuge in the most fragrant room on the island. All that sheep aroma must have masked our scent, because after a minute, the creature seemed to give up and reeled out the window. We heard its retreating steps. Emma's hand came away from her mouth, and she let out a shuddering breath.
I think it's taking the bait, she whispered.
I want you to know something, I said. If we make it through this, I'm staying. She grabbed my hand.
Do you mean it?
I can't go home. Not after all that's happened. Anyway, whatever help I can be, I owe you that and a lot more. You were all perfectly safe until I got here.
If we make it through this, she said, leaning into me, then I don't regret one thing. And then some strange magnet was pulling our heads together, but just as our lips were about to touch, the quiet was shattered by terrified, bleeding shrieks from the next room. We pulled apart as the awful noise set the sheep around us into frantic motion, bounding off one another and pushing us into the wall. The beast was not as dumb as I'd hoped. We could hear it coming toward us through the house. If there was a time to run, it had already passed, so we screwed ourselves into the reeking soil and prayed it would pass us by. And then I could smell it, even more pungent than the house's other stinks, and I could feel it at the threshold of the room. All the sheep pushed away from the door at once, herding together like a school of fish and pinning us against the wall so hard the breath was pressed out of us. We gripped each other, but didn't dare make a sound, and for an unbearably tense moment, we heard only the bleating of sheep and the clop of staggering hooves. Then another hoarse scream erupted, sudden and desperate, and just as suddenly silenced, broken off by lurid, ripping bone snap. I knew without looking that a sheep had just been torn apart. Chaos broke out. Panicked animals ricocheted off one another, throwing us against the wall so many times I got dizzy. The hollow let out an ear-splitting screech and began to lift sheep to its slavering jaws one after another, taking a blood-spurting bite from each and then tossing it aside like a gluttonous king gorging at a medieval feast. It did this again and again, killing its way toward us. I was paralyzed with fear. That's why I can't quite explain what happened next. My every instinct screamed to stay hidden, to dig myself even deeper into the muck, but then one clear thought cut through all the static. I won't let us die in this shithouse. And I pushed Emma behind the biggest sheep I could see and bolted for the door. The door was closed, and 10 feet away, and a lot of animals stood between it and me, but I plowed through them like a linebacker. I hit the door with my shoulder, and it flung open. I tumbled outside into the rain and screamed, "Come get me, you ugly bastard!" I knew I had its attention, because it let out a terrifying howl, and sheep came flushing out the door past me. I scrambled to my feet, and when I was sure it was coming after me and not Emma, I took off toward the bog. I could feel it behind me. I might have run faster, but I was still holding the shears. I couldn't seem to make myself let go. And then the ground went soft beneath me, and I knew I'd reached the bog. Twice, the hollow was close enough for its tongues to lash my back, and twice, just as I was certain one was about to lasso my neck and squeeze until my head popped, it stumbled and fell back. The only reason I made it to the cairn with my head still attached was that I knew exactly where to put my feet. Thanks to Emma, I could run that route on a moonless night in half a hurricane. Clambering onto the cairn mound, I tore around to the stone entrance and dove in. It was black as tar inside, but it didn't matter. I only had to reach the chamber to be safe. I scrambled on my hands and knees, because even standing would have cost time I didn't have to waste, and I was halfway to the end and feeling cautiously optimistic about my chances for survival when suddenly I could crawl no more. One of the tongues had caught my ankle. The hollow had used two of its tongues to grapple onto the capstones around the tunnel's mouth as leverage against the mud, and it covered the entrance with its body like a lid on a jar. The third tongue was reeling me toward it. I was a fish on a hook. I scrabbled at the ground, but it was all gravel, and my finger slid right through. I flipped onto my back and clawed at the stones with my free hand, but I was sliding too quickly. I tried hacking at the tongue with my shears, but it was too sinewy and tough, a rope of undulating muscle, and my shears too dull. So I squeezed my eyes shut because I didn't want its gaping jaws to be the last thing I'd ever see, and gripped the shears in front of me with both hands. Time seemed to stretch out, like they say it does in car crashes and train accidents and free falls from airplanes, and the next thing I felt was a bone-jarring collision as I slammed into the hollow. All the breath rushed out of me, and I heard it scream.
We flew out of the tunnel together and rolled down the cairn mound into the bog, and when I opened my eyes again, I saw my shears buried to the hilt in the beast's eye sockets. It howled like 10 pigs being gelded, rolling and thrashing in the rain-swollen mud, weeping a black river of itself, viscous fluid pumping over the blade's rusted handle. I could feel it dying, the life draining out of it, its tongue loosening around my ankle. I could feel the difference in me, too, the panicky clutch in my stomach slowly coming undone. Finally, the creature stiffened and sank from view, slime closing over its head, a slick of dark blood, the only sign it had ever been there. I could feel the bog sucking me down with it. The more I struggled, the more it seemed to want me. What a strange find the two of us would make 1,000 years from now, I thought, preserved together in the peat. I tried to paddle toward solid ground, but succeeded only in pushing myself deeper. The muck seemed to climb me, rising up my arms, my chest, collaring my throat like a noose. I screamed for help, and miraculously, help came, in the form of what I thought at first was a firefly, flashing as it flew toward me. Then I heard Emma call out, and I answered. A tree branch landed in the water. I grabbed it, and Emma pulled, and when I finally came out of the bog, I was shaking too hard to stand. Emma sank down beside me, and I fell into her arms. I killed it, I thought. I really killed it. All the time I'd spent being afraid, I never dreamed I could actually kill one. It made me feel powerful. Now I could defend myself. I knew I'd never be as strong as my grandfather, but I wasn't a gutless weakling either. I could kill them. I tested out the words. It's dead. I killed it. I laughed. Emma hugged me, pressing her cheek against mine. I know he would have been proud of you, she said. We kissed, and it was gentle and nice, rain dripping from our noses and running warm into our just open mouths. Too soon, she broke away and whispered, What you said before, did you mean it? I'll stay, I said. If Miss Peregrine will let me. She will. I'll make certain of it. Before we worry about that, we'd better find my psychiatrist and take away his gun. Right, she said, her expression hardening. No time to waste, then. We left the rain behind and emerged into a landscape of smoke and noise. The loop hadn't yet reset, and the bog was pocked with bomb holes. The sky buzzing with planes, walls of orange flame marching against the distant tree line. I was about to suggest we wait until today became yesterday and all this disappeared before trying to cross to the house when a set of brawny arms clapped around me. You're alive, Bronwyn cried. Enoch and Hugh were with her, and when she pulled away, they moved in to shake my hand and look me over. I'm sorry I called you a traitor, Enoch said. I'm glad you're not dead. Me too, I replied. All in one piece? Hugh asked, looking me over. Two arms and two legs, I said, kicking out my limbs to demonstrate their wholeness. And you won't have to worry about that hollow anymore. We killed it.
Oh, stuff the modesty, Emma said proudly. You killed it. That's brilliant, Hugh said, but neither he nor the other two could muster a smile.
What's the matter? I asked. Wait, why aren't you three at the house? Where's Miss Peregrine?
She's gone, said Bronwyn, her lip trembling. Miss Avocet, too. He took them. Oh, God, said Emma.
We were too late.
He come in with a gun, Hugh said. Studying the dirt. Tried to take Claire hostage, but she chomped him with her back mouth, so he grabbed me instead. I tried to fight, but he knocked me upside the skull with his gun.
He touched the back of his ear, and his fingers came away spotted with blood.
Locked everyone in the basement, and said if Headmistress and Miss Avocet didn't change into birds, he'd put an extra hole in my head. So they did,
and he stuffed them both into a cage.
He had a cage? Emma said.
Hugh nodded.
Little one too, so they didn't have room to do nothing, like change back or fly off. I reckoned I was good as shot, but then he pushed me down the basement with the others and run off with the birds.
That's how we found him when we come in, Enoch said bitterly.
Hiding down there like a lot of cowards.
We wasn't hiding, Hugh cried. He locked us in. He would have shot us.
Forget that, snapped Emma. Where'd he run off to? Why didn't you go after him?
We don't know where he went, said Bronwyn. We was hoping you'd see him.
No, we haven't seen him, Emma said, kicking a Cairn stone in frustration.
Hugh drew something out of his shirt. It was a little photograph, a snapshot of a dead bird splayed out on the ground beneath the rifle that had killed it. At one edge of the frame lurked a menacing shadow. Clearly, this was meant as a threat.
He stuffed this in my pocket before he went. Said if we try to come after him, this is what would happen.
Bronwyn snatched the photo from Hugh.
Oh, she gasped. Is that Miss Raven?
I think it's Miss Crow, said Hugh, rubbing his face with his hands.
That's it. They're as good as dead, Enoch moaned. I knew this day would come.
We should never have left the house, Emma said miserably. Millard was right.
At the far edge of the bog, a bomb fell, its muted blast followed by a distant rain of excavated glop. Wait a minute, I said. First of all, we don't know that this is Miss Crow or Miss Raven. It could just as easily be a picture of a regular crow, and if Golan was going to kill Miss Peregrine and Miss Avocet, why would he go to all the trouble of kidnapping them? If he wanted them dead, they'd be dead already. I turned to Emma. And if we hadn't left, we'd be locked in the basement with everybody else, and there'd still be a Hologhast wandering around.
Don't try to make me feel better, she said. It's your fault this is happening. 10 minutes ago, you said you were glad.
10 minutes ago, Miss Peregrine wasn't kidnapped.
Will you stop? Said Hugh.
All that matters now is that the bird's gone and we've got to get her back.
Fine, I said. So let's think. If you were a white, where would you take a couple of kidnapped Imbrins?
Depends on what's to be done with them, Enoch said. And that we don't know.
You'd have to get them off the island first, Emma said. So you'd need a boat.
But which island? Asked Hugh.
In the loop or out of it?
The outside's getting torn apart by a storm, I said. Nobody's getting far in a boat over there.
Then he's got to be on our side, Emma said, beginning to sound hopeful. So what are we larking about here for? Let's get to the docks.
Maybe he's at the docks, Enoch said. That is, if he ain't gone yet.
And even if he ain't, and we somehow manage to find him in all this dark, and without getting holes ripped through our guts by shrapnel on the way, there's still his gun to worry about. Have you all gone mad? Would you rather have the bird kidnapped or shot right in front of us?
Fine, then, Hugh shouted.
Let's just give up and go home, then, shall we? Who'd like a nice hot cup of tea before bed? Hell, as long as the bird ain't around, make it a toddy.
He was crying, wiping angrily at his eyes.
How can you not even try, after all she's done for us?
Before Enoch could answer, we heard a voice calling us from the path. Hugh stepped forward, squinting, and after a moment, his face went strange.
It's Fiona,
he said. Before that moment, I'd never heard Fiona utter so much as a peep. It was impossible to make out what she was saying over the sound of planes and distant concussions, so we took off running across the bog. When we got to the path, we were breathing hard, and Fiona was hoarse from shouting, her eyes as wild as her hair. Immediately, she began to pull at us, to drag and push us down the path toward town, yelling so frantically in her thick Irish accent that none of us could understand.
Hugh caught her by the shoulders and told her to slow down. She took a deep breath, shaking like a leaf, then pointed behind her.
"Mellid followed him," she said. "He was hiding when the man shut us all in the basement, and when he lit out, Mellid followed."
"Where to?" I said.
"He had a boat."
"See," cried Emma, "the dogs."
"No," said Fiona. "It was your boat, Emma. The one you think nobody knows about, that you keep stowed on that wee strand of yours. He launched off with the cage and was just going in circles, but then the tide got too rough, so he pulled onto the lighthouse rock, and that's where he still is."
We made for the lighthouse in a dead run. When we reached the cliffs overlooking it, we found the rest of the children in a thick patch of sawgrass near the edge.
"Get down!" Millard hissed.
We dropped to our knees and crawled over to them. They were crouched in a loose huddle behind the grass, taking turns peeking at the lighthouse. They looked shell-shocked, the younger ones especially, as if they hadn't fully grasped the unfolding nightmare. That we'd just survived a nightmare of our own barely registered. I crawled through the grass to the edge of the cliff and peered out. Past where the shipwreck lay submerged, I could see Emma's canoe tied to the rocks. Golan and the Imbrins were out of sight. "What's he doing out there?" I said.
"It's anyone's guess," Millard answered, "waiting for someone to pick him up or for the tide to settle so he can row out."
"In my little boat?" Emma said doubtfully.
"As I said, we don't know."
Three deafening cracks sounded in quick succession, and we all ducked as the sky flashed orange.
"To any bombs fall round here, Millard?" asked Emma.
"My research concerns only the behavior of humans and animals," he replied, "not bombs."
"Fat lot of good that does us now," said Enoch.
"Do you have any more boats hidden around here?" I asked Emma.
"I'm afraid not," she said. "We'll just have to swim across."
"Swim across in what?" said Millard. "Get shot to pieces?"
"We'll figure something out," she replied.
Millard sighed. "Oh, lovely. Improvised suicide."
"Well,"
Emma looked at each of us, "does anyone have a better idea?"
"If I had my soldiers," Enoch began. "They'd fall to bits in the water," said Millard.
Enoch hung his head. The others were quiet.
"Then it's decided," said Emma. "Who's in?"
I raised my hand. So did Bronwyn. "You'll need someone the white can't see," Millard said. "Take me along, if you must."
"Four's enough," Emma said. "Hope you're all strong swimmers."
There was no time for second thoughts or long goodbyes. The others wished us luck, and we were on our way. We shed our black coats and loped through the grass, doubled over like commandos until we came to the path that led to the beach. We slid down on our behinds, little avalanches of sand pouring around our feet and down our pants. Suddenly, there was a noise like 50 chainsaws over our heads, and we ducked as a plane roared by, the wind whipping our hair and blowing up a sandstorm. I clenched my teeth, waiting for a bomb blast to tear us apart. None came. We kept moving. When we hit the beach, Emma gathered us in a tight huddle.
"There's a shipwreck between here and the lighthouse," she said. "Follow me out to it. Stay low in the water. Don't let him see you. When we reach the wreck, we'll look for our man and decide what's next."
"Let's get our Imbrins back," Bronwyn said.
We crawled down to the surf and slid into the cold water on our bellies. It was easy going at first, but the farther we swam from the shore, the more the current tried to push us back. Another plane buzzed overhead, kicking up a stinging spray of water. We were breathing hard by the time we reached the shipwreck. Clinging to its rusted hull, just our heads poking out of the water, we stared at the lighthouse and the barren little island that anchored it, but saw no sign of my wayward therapist. A full moon hovered low in the sky, breaking through reefs of bomb smoke now and then to shine like the lighthouse's ghostly double. We pushed ourselves along the wreck until we reached the end, just a 50-yard swim in open water to the lighthouse rocks.
"Here's what I reckon we should do," Emma said. "He's seen how strong Wynne is, so she's in the most danger. Jacob and I find Golan and get his attention while Wynne sneaks up from behind and gives him a belter over the head. Meantime, Millard makes a grab for the birdcage. Any objections?"
As if in answer, a shot rang out. At first we didn't realize what it was. It didn't sound like the gunshots we'd been hearing, distant and powerful. This was small caliber, a pop, rather than a bang. And it wasn't until we heard a second one, accompanied by a nearby splash, that we knew it was Golan.
"Fall back!"
Emma shouted, and we stood out of the water and sprinted across the hull until it dropped out from beneath us, then dove into the open water beyond it. A moment later, we all came up in a cluster, panting for air.
"So much for getting the drop on him," Millard said.
Golan had stopped shooting, but we could see him standing guard by the lighthouse door, gun in hand.
"He may be an evil bastard, but he ain't stupid," Bronwyn said. "He knew we'd come after him."
"Not now we can't," Emma said, slapping the water. "He'll shoot us to bits."
Millard stepped up onto the wreck.
"He can't shoot what he can't see. I'll go."
"You're not invisible in the ocean, dummy,"
Emma said. And it was true. A torso-shaped negative space bobbed in the water where he stood.
"More than you are," he replied. "Anyhow, I followed him all the way across the island, and he was none the wiser. I think I can manage a few hundred meters more."
It was difficult to argue, since our only remaining options were either giving up or running into a hail of gunfire.
"Fine," Emma said. "If you really think you can make it."
"Someone's got to be the hero,"
he replied, and walked off across the hull.
"Famous last words," I muttered.
In the smoky distance, I saw Golan in the lighthouse doorway kneel down and take aim, leveling his arm across a railing.
"Look out!"
I shouted, but it was too late. A shot rang out. Millard screamed. We all clambered onto the wreck and raced toward him. I felt absolutely certain I was about to be shot, and for a moment I thought the splashes of our feet in the water were bullets raining down on us. But then the shooting stopped. Reloading, I thought, and we had a brief window of time. Millard was kneeling in the water, dazed, blood running down his torso. For the first time, I could see the true shape of his body, painted red. Emma took him by the arm.
"Millard, are you all right? Say something."
"I must apologize," he said. "It seems I've gone and gotten myself shot."
"We have to stop the bleeding," said Emma. "We've got to take him back to shore."
"Nonsense," Millard said. "That man will never let you get this close to him again. Turn back now, and we'll certainly lose Miss Peregrine."
More shots rang out. I felt a bullet zip past my ear.
"This way,"
Emma shouted.
"Dive!"
I didn't know what she meant at first. We were 100 feet from the end of the wreck. But then I saw what she was running toward. It was the black hole in the hull, the door to the cargo hold. Bronwyn and I lifted Millard and ran after her. Metal slugs clanged into the hull around us. It sounded like someone kicking a trash can.
"Hold your breath,"
I told Millard, and we came to the hold and dove in feet first. We pulled ourselves down the ladder a few rungs and hung there. I tried to keep my eyes open, but the salt water stung too much. I could taste Millard's blood in the water. Emma handed me the breathing tube, and we passed it among us. I was winded from running, and the single breath that allowed me every few seconds wasn't enough. My lungs hurt, and I began to feel lightheaded. Someone tugged at my shirt. "Come up." I pulled myself slowly up the ladder, and then Bronwyn, Emma, and I broke the surface just enough to breathe and talk while Millard stayed safe a few feet below, the tube all to himself. We spoke in whispers and kept our eyes on the lighthouse.
"We can't stay here," Emma said. "Millard would bleed to death."
"It could take 20 minutes to get him back to shore," I said. "He could just as easily die on the way."
"I don't know what else to do."
"The lighthouse is close," Bronwyn said. "We'll take him there."
"Then Golan will make us all bleed to death," I said.
"No, he won't," replied Bronwyn.
"Why not? Are you bulletproof?"
"Maybe," Bronwyn replied mysteriously, then took a breath and disappeared down the ladder.
"What's she talking about?" I said.
Emma looked worried.
"I haven't a clue, but whatever it is, she'd better hurry."
I looked down to see what Bronwyn was doing, but instead caught a glimpse of Millard on the ladder below us, surrounded by curious flashlight fish. Then I felt the hull vibrate against my feet, and a moment later, Bronwyn surfaced holding a rectangular piece of metal about 6 feet by 4 with a riveted round hole in the top. She had wrenched the cargo hold's door from its hinges.
"And what are you going to do with that?"
Emma said.
"Go to the lighthouse," she replied.
Then she stood up and held the door in front of her.
"When? He'll shoot you,"
Emma cried, and then a shot rang out and caromed right off the door.
"That's amazing," I said. "It's a shield."
Emma laughed.
"When? You're a genius."
"Millard could ride my back," she said. "The rest of you fall in behind." Emma brought Millard out of the water and hung his arms around Bronwyn's neck.
"It's magnificent down there," he said.
"Emma, why did you never tell me about the angels?"
"What angels?"
"The lovely green angels who live just below."
He was shivering, his voice dreamy.
"They kindly offered to take me to heaven."
"No one's going to heaven just yet," Emma said, looking worried.
"You just hang on to Bronwyn, all right?"
"Very well," he said vacantly.
Emma stood behind Millard, pressing him into Bronwyn's back so he wouldn't slide off. I stood behind Emma, taking up the rear of our strange little conga line, and we began to plod forward across the wreck toward the lighthouse. We were a big target, and right away, Golan began to empty his gun at us. The sound of his bullets bouncing off the door was deafening, but somehow reassuring. But after about a dozen shots, he stopped. I wasn't optimistic enough to think he'd run out of bullets, though. Reaching the end of the wreck, Bronwyn guided us carefully into open water, always keeping the massive door held out in front of us. Our conga line became a chain of dog paddlers swimming in a knot behind her. Emma talked to Millard as we paddled, making him answer questions so he wouldn't drift into unconsciousness.
"Millard, who's the Prime Minister?"
"Winston Churchill," he said. "Have you gone daft?"
"What's the capital of Burma?"
"Lord, I've no idea. Rangoon?"
"Good. When's your birthday?"
"Will you quit shouting and let me bleed in peace?"
It didn't take long to cross the short distance between the wreck and the lighthouse. As Bronwyn shouldered our shield and climbed onto the rocks, Golan fired a few more shots, and their impact threw her off balance. As we cowered behind her, she wobbled and nearly slipped backward off the rocks, which between her weight and the doors would have crushed us all. Emma planted her hands on the small of Bronwyn's back and pushed, and finally both Bronwyn and the door tottered forward onto dry land. We scrambled after her in a pack, shivering in the crisp night air. 50 yards across at its widest, the lighthouse rocks were technically a tiny island. At the lighthouse's rusted base were a dozen stone steps leading to an open door where Golan stood with his pistol aimed squarely in our direction. I risked a peek through the porthole. He held a small cage in one hand, and inside were 2 flapping birds mashed so close together I could hardly tell one from the other. A shot whizzed past and I ducked.
Come any closer and I'll shoot them both, Golan shouted, rattling the cage.
He's lying, I said. He needs them.
You don't know that, said Emma. He's a madman, after all.
Well, we can't just do nothing.
Rush him, Bronwyn said. He won't know what to do. But if it's going to work, we've got to go now.
And before we had a chance to weigh in, Bronwyn was running toward the lighthouse. We had no choice but to follow. She was carrying our protection, after all, and a moment later, bullets were clanging against the door and chipping at the rocks around our feet. It was like hanging from the back of a speeding train. Bronwyn was terrifying. She bellowed like a barbarian, the veins in her neck bulging, with Millard's blood smeared all over her arms and back. I was very glad, in that moment, not to be on the other side of the door. As we neared the lighthouse, Bronwyn shouted, "Get behind the wall!" Emma and I grabbed Millard and cut left to take cover behind the far side of the lighthouse. As we ran, I saw Bronwyn lift the door above her head and hurl it toward Golan. There was a thunderous crash, quickly followed by a scream, and moments later, Bronwyn joined us behind the wall, flushed and panting.
"I think I hit him," she said excitedly. "What about the birds?" Emma said. "Did you even think about them?"
"He dropped him. They're fine."
"Well, you might have asked us before you went berserk and risked all our lives," Emma cried.
"Quiet," I hissed. We heard the faint sound of creaking metal. "What is that?"
"He's climbing the stairs," Emma replied.
"You'd better get after him," croaked Millard. We looked at him, surprised. He was slumped against the wall.
"Not before we take care of you," I said. "Who knows how to make a tourniquet?"
Bronwyn reached down and tore the leg of her pants.
"I do," she said. "I'll stop his bleeding. You get the white. I knocked him pretty good, but not good enough. Don't give him a chance to get his wind back."
I turned to Emma. "You up for this?"
"If it means I get to melt that white's face off," she said,
little arcs of flame pulsing between her hands.
"Then absolutely."
Emma and I clambered over the ship's door, which lay bent on the steps where it had landed, and entered the lighthouse. The building consisted mainly of one narrow and profoundly vertical room, a giant stairwell essentially, dominated by a skeletal staircase that corkscrewed from the floor to a stone landing more than 100 feet up. We could hear Golan's footsteps as he bounded up the stairs, but it was too dark to tell how far he was from the top.
"Can you see him?" I said, peering up the stairwell's dizzying height.
My answer was a gunshot ricocheting off a wall nearby, followed by another that slammed into the floor at my feet. I jumped back, heart hammering.
"Over here,"
Emma cried. She grabbed my arm and pulled me farther inside, to the one place Golan's gunshots couldn't reach us, directly under the stairs. We climbed a few steps, which were already swaying like a boat in bad weather.
"These are frightful,"
Emma exclaimed, her fingers white-knuckled as they gripped the rail.
"Even if we make it to the top without falling, he'll only shoot us."
"If we can't go up," I said, "maybe we can bring him down."
I began to rock back and forth where I stood, yanking on the railing and stomping my feet, sending shockwaves up the stairs. Emma looked at me like I was nuts for a second, but then got the idea and began to stomp and sway along with me. Pretty soon the staircase was rocking like crazy.
"What if the whole thing comes down?" Emma shouted.
"Let's hope it doesn't." We shook harder. Screws and bolts began to rain down. The rail was lurching so violently, I could hardly keep hold of it. I heard Golan scream a spectacular array of curses, and then something clattered down the stairs, landing nearby. The first thing I thought was, "Oh, God, what if that was the birdcage?" And I dashed down the stairs past Emma and ran out on the floor to check.
"What are you doing?" Emma shouted. "He'll shoot you."
"No, he won't," I said, holding up Golan's handgun in triumph. It felt warm from all the firing he'd done and heavy in my hand,
and I had no idea if it still had bullets or even how, in the near darkness, to check. I tried in vain to remember something useful from the few shooting lessons Grandpa had been allowed to give me, but finally, I just ran back up the steps to Emma. "He's trapped at the top," I said. "We've got to take it slow. Try to reason with him, or who knows what'll do to the birds."
"I'll reason him right over the side," Emma replied through her teeth.
We began to climb. The staircase swayed terribly and was so narrow that we could only proceed in single file, crouching, so our heads wouldn't hit the steps above. I prayed that none of the fasteners we'd shaken loose had secured anything crucial. We slowed as we neared the top. I didn't dare look down. There were only my feet on the steps, my hand sliding along the shivering rail, and my other hand holding the gun. Nothing else existed. I steeled myself for a surprise attack, but none came. The stairs ended at an opening in the stone landing above our heads, through which I could feel the snapping chill of night air and hear the whistle of wind. I stuck the gun through, followed by my head. I was tense and ready to fight, but I didn't see Golan. On one side of me spun the massive light, housed behind thick glass. This close, it was blinding, forcing me to shut my eyes as it swung past, and on the other side was a spindly rail. Beyond that was a void, 10 stories of empty air and then rocks and churning sea. I stepped onto the narrow walkway and turned to give Emma a hand up. We stood with our backs pressed against the lamp's warm housing and our fronts to the wind's chill.
"The bird's close," Emma whispered. "I can feel her."
She flicked her wrist and a ball of angry red flame sprang to life. Something about its color and intensity made it clear that this time she hadn't summoned a light, but a weapon.
"We should split up," I said. "You go around one side, and I'll take the other. That way, he won't be able to sneak past us."
"I'm scared, Jacob."
"Me too, but he's hurt, and we have his gun."
She nodded and touched my arm, then turned away. I circled the lamp slowly, clenching the maybe-loaded gun, and gradually the view around the other side began to peel back. I found Golan sitting on his haunches with his head down and his back against the railing, the birdcage between his knees. He was bleeding badly from a cut on the bridge of his nose, rivulets of red streaking his face like tears. Clipped to the bars of the cage was a small red light. Every few seconds, it blinked. I took another step forward, and he raised his head to look at me. His face was a stubble of caked blood. His one white eye shot through with red, spit flecking the corners of his mouth. He rose unsteadily, the cage in one hand.
"Put it down."
He bent over as if to comply, but faked away from me and tried to run. I shouted and gave chase, but as soon as he disappeared around the lamp housing, I saw the glow of Emma's fire flare across the concrete. Golan came howling back toward me, his hair smoking and one arm covering his face.
"Stop!"
I screamed at him, and he realized he was trapped. He raised the cage, shielding himself, and gave it a vicious shake. The bird screeched and nipped at his hand through the bars.
"Is this what you want?" Golan shouted. "Go ahead, burn me. The birds will burn too. Shoot me, and I'll throw them over the side."
"Not if I shoot you in the head."
He laughed. "You couldn't fire a gun if you wanted to. You forget, I'm intimately familiar with your poor, fragile psyche. It'd give you nightmares."
I tried to imagine it, curling my finger around the trigger and squeezing, the recoil and the awful report. What was so hard about that? Why did my hand shake just thinking about it? How many whites had my grandfather killed? Dozens? Hundreds? If he were here instead of me, Golan would be dead already, laid out while he'd been squatting against the rail in a daze. It was an opportunity I'd already wasted, a split second of gutless indecision that might have cost the Imbrins their lives. The giant lamps spun past, blasting us with light, turning us into glowing white cutouts. Golan, who was facing it, grimaced and looked away. Another wasted opportunity, I thought.
Just put it down and come with us, I said. Nobody else has to get hurt.
I don't know, Emma said. If Miller doesn't make it, I might reconsider that.
You want to kill me? Golan said. Fine. Get it over with. But you'll only be delaying the inevitable. Not to mention making things worse for yourselves. We know how to find you now. More like me are coming, and I can guarantee the collateral damage they do will make what I did to your friend seem downright charitable.
Get it over with, Emma said, her flame sending a little pulse of spark skyward. Who said it would be quick?
I told you I'll kill them, he said, drawing the cage to his chest. She took a step toward him.
I'm 88 years old, she said. Do I look like I need a pair of babysitters?
Her expression was steely, unreadable.
I can't tell you how long we've been dying to get out from under that woman's wing. I swear, you'd be doing us a favor.
Golan swiveled his head back and forth, nervously sizing us up. Is she serious? For a moment, he seemed genuinely frightened, but then he said,
You're full of shit.
Emma rubbed her palms together and pulled them slowly apart, drawing out a noose of flame.
Let's find out.
I wasn't sure how far Emma would take this, but I had to step in before the birds went up in flames or were sent tumbling over the rail.
Tell us what you want with those Imbrins, and maybe she'll go easy on you, I said.
We only want to finish what we started, Golan said. That's all we've ever wanted.
You mean the experiment, Emma said. You tried it once, and look what happened. You turn yourselves into monsters.
Yes, he said. But what an unchallenging life it would be if we always got things right on the first go. He smiled. This time, we'll be harnessing the talents of all the world's best time manipulators, like these two ladies here. We won't fail again. We had 100 years to figure out what went wrong. Turns out all we needed was a bigger reaction.
A bigger reaction?
I said. Last time you blew up half of Siberia.
If you must fail, he said grandly, fail spectacularly.
I remembered Horace's prophetic dream of ash clouds and scorched earth, and I realized what he'd been seeing. If the Whites and Hollows failed again, this time they'd destroy a lot more than 500 miles of empty forest. And if they succeeded and turned themselves into the deathless demigods they'd always dreamed of becoming, I shuddered to imagine it. Living under them would be a hell all its own. The light came around and blinded Golan again. I tensed, ready to lunge, but the moment sped by too quickly.
It doesn't matter, Emma said. Kidnap all the Imbrins you want. They'll never help you.
Yes, they will. They'll do it, or we'll kill them one by one. And if that doesn't work, we'll kill you one by one and make them watch.
You're insane, I told him.
The birds began to panic and screech. Golan shouted over them.
No! What's really insane is how you peculiars hide from the world when you could rule it, succumb to death when you could dominate it, and let the common genetic trash of the human race drive you underground when you could so easily make them your slaves, and they rightly should be.
He drove home every sentence with another shake of the cage.
That's insane!
Stop it! Emma shouted.
So you do care.
He shook the cage even harder. Suddenly, the little red light attached to its bars began to glow twice as bright, and Golan whipped his head around and searched the darkness behind him. Then he looked back at Emma and said,
You want them? Here!
And he pulled back and swung the cage at her face. She cried out and ducked. Like a discus thrower, Golan continued the swing until the cage sailed over her head, then released. It flew out of his hands and over the rail, tumbling end over end into the night. I cursed, and Emma screamed and threw herself against the rail, clawing at the air as the cage fell toward the sea. In that moment of confusion, Golan leapt and knocked me to the ground. He slammed a fist into my stomach and another into my chin. I was dizzy and couldn't breathe. He grabbed for the gun, and it took every bit of my strength to keep him from snatching it. Because he wanted it so badly, I knew it must have been loaded. I would have thrown it over the rail, but he almost had it and I couldn't let go. Emma was screaming, "Bastard! You bastard!" And then her hands, gloved in flame, came from behind and seized him around the neck. I heard Golan's flesh singe like a cold steak on a hot grill. He howled and rolled off me, his thin hair going up in flame, and then his hands were around Emma's throat, as though he didn't mind burning as long as he could choke the life out of her. I jumped to my feet, held the gun in both hands, and pointed it. I had, just for a moment, a clear shot. I tried to empty my mind and focus on steadying my arm, creating an imaginary line that extended from my shoulder through the sight to my target, a man's head. No, not a man, but a corruption of one. A thing. A force that had arranged the murder of my grandfather and exploded all that I'd humbly called a life, poorly lived though it may have been, and carried me here to this place and this moment. In much the way less corrupt and violent forces had done my living and deciding for me since I was old enough to decide anything. Relax your hands, breathe in, hold it. But now I had a chance to force back, a slim nothing of a chance that I could already feel slipping away. Now squeeze. The pistol bucked in my hands and its report sounded like the earth breaking open, so tremendous and sudden that I shut my eyes. When I opened them again, everything seemed strangely frozen. Though Golan stood behind Emma with her arms locked in a hold, wrestling her toward the railing, it was as if they'd been cast in bronze. Had the Imbrins turned human again and worked their magic on us? But then everything came unstuck, and Emma wrenched her arms away, and Golan began to totter backward, and he stumbled and sat heavily on the rail. Gaping at me in surprise, he opened his mouth to speak, but he found he could not. He clapped his hands over the penny-sized hole I'd made in his throat, blood lacing through his fingers and running down his arms, and then the strength went out of him, and he fell back, and he was gone. The moment Golan disappeared from view, he was forgotten. Emma pointed out to sea and shouted, "There! There!" Following her finger, and squinting into the distance, I could barely pick out the pulse of a red LED bobbing on the waves. Then we were scrambling to the hatch and sprinting down and down the endless, seesawing staircase, hopeless that we could reach the cage before it sank, but hysterical to try to anyway. We tore outside to find Millard wearing a tourniquet and Bronwyn by his side. He shouted something I didn't quite hear, but it was enough to assure me he was alive. I grabbed Emma's shoulder and said, "The boat!" pointing to where the stolen canoe had been lashed to a rock. But it was too far away, on the wrong side of the lighthouse, and there was no time. Emma pulled me instead toward the open sea, and running, we dashed ourselves into it. I hardly felt the cold. All I could think about was reaching the cage before it disappeared beneath the waves. We tore at the water and sputtered and choked as black swells slapped our faces. It was difficult to tell how far away the beacon was, just a single point of light in a surging ocean of dark. It bobbed and fell and came and went, and twice we lost sight of it and had to stop, searching frantically before spotting it again. The strong current was carrying the cage out to sea, and us with it. If we didn't reach it soon, our muscles would fail, and we'd drown. I kept this morbid thought to myself for as long as I could, but when the beacon disappeared a third time, and we looked for it so long we couldn't be sure what section of the rolling black sea it had disappeared from, I shouted,
We have to go back. Emma wouldn't listen. She swam ahead of me, farther out to sea. I grasped at her scissoring feet, but she kicked me off. It's gone.